Greetings, this is Tyler McFeeters with your Decatur Herald and Review, dated Tuesday, July 15th, 2025. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with an article headlined, Sports Deputy Tracks Down Four Medals. Macon County's Major Scores at World Police and Fire Games. Story by Donette Beckett. Out of Decatur. Competing in track events was just like riding a bicycle or throwing a shot for Seth Major. 2 weeks ago, the 39-year-old Macon County Sheriff's Office deputy took part in the 2025 World Police and Fire Games in Alabama, competing in the shot, discus, javelin, and hammer throw events, bringing home four medals. My first time out, and I got three silvers and a bronze, he said. It was good to get back into the competitive side again. Graduating from Meridian High School in 2005 and University of Memphis in 2010, Major hadn't participated in the sports or even performed moves similar to the field events since then. I helped some kids and coached here and there, he said. However, after only a year of training, Major was ready to pick up a javelin, metal ball, discus, and a large hammer to compete in the police games. His decision was made after he studied the 2023 winners in his age bracket. I thought I could probably do better than that. I thought I could probably do that, he said. Training included weightlifting designed for the events in which he would participate. That made a big difference, Major said. The competitions were held June 30th through July 3rd in Birmingham, Alabama. According to the organizers, the biennial World Police and Fire Games were first held in 1985 in San Jose, California. The World Police and Fire Games aim to offer the same variety of sports and the same high caliber of venues, officials, and athletic achievement as the original California Police Games, but on a global scale, the organizers stated on their website. The games include Olympic-style sports as well as a few extra. Other competing first responders traveled from all over the world to compete, including Canada, India, Spain, Germany, and the United Kingdom. Those invited to compete included police, fire, and correctional officers and paramedics. Along with track and field, the nearly 80 competitions included cornhole, disc golf, pickleball, stair races, canine competitions, and dodgeball. Major reached out to former and local coaches for training, especially for the hammer throw and javelin, the two events he had little experience with. Those two were just something to do, he said, but once I got in the competition, my competitive side took over. Major's wife and two daughters were at the competition to cheer on the patriarch of the family. While watching one of the basketball games, his 10-year-old daughter, Isla, was given a police uniform medal from an Iraqi competitor. That comes from the police part of it, he said. A lot of guys have challenge coins or patches that they trade. Major isn't done training. He's now preparing for the next games, the 2027 World Police and Fire Games in Perth, Australia. You have to practice more, he said. Just have to practice more, he said. His age group included competitors from 34 to 39 years old. I was the oldest in everything, he said about this year's competition. 2 years from now, I may be one of the younger in the bracket. The older age groups impressed Major the most, he said. Retirees have their own category. Two men, more than 80 years old, caught his eye. To watch those guys competing was pretty motivating, Major said. They were probably the most proud when they got up on the medal stand. Next on the front page stories is U.S. politics. How the Know-Nothings, Free Soilers, and other third parties shaped U.S. politics. Story by Jonathan J. Cooper of the Associated Press. Elon Musk's plan to create a new political party puts him in the company of a long line of business and political titans looking to upend the two-party system that has dominated U.S. politics since almost the beginning. From the anti-Masonic party in the early 1800s to last year's ill-fated No Labels, nascent political parties have been a near-constant feature of U.S. politics. Some are impactful, but few endure for long. Though the Republican and Democratic parties have had a lock on political power since the Civil War, they have remade themselves over and over, often when faced with the prospect of losing voters to third parties. The name Musk chose, the America Party, is bland compared to some of history's more memorable movements, the Know Nothing Party, the Bull Moose Party, the Dixiecrats. Musk's plans remain murky, but some of his public comments suggest he's eyeing a limited goal, focusing on a handful of House races to gain influence without trying to win a majority. One way to execute on this would be to laser focus on just two or three Senate seats and 8 to 10 House districts, Musk wrote on X. Given the razor-thin legislative margins, that would be enough to serve as the deciding vote on contentious laws, ensuring that they serve the true will of the people. Here's a look at how third parties have made their mark through American history, even without winning the White House or congressional majorities. Anti-Masonic Party. The first third party, the Anti-Masons, emerged in 1828 in opposition to the Freemasons, a secret society. The disappearance of William Morgan, a former Mason who had threatened to expose secrets, fueled widespread paranoia about the shadowy group, which many believed was covertly controlling the government. The Anti-Masons evolved into a broadly anti-elite party. They were the first party to hold a convention to nominate a presidential candidate and to adopt a party platform, pioneering enduring staples of American democracy. They held seats in the House for a decade, peaking at 25 after the 1832 election. That year, anti-Mason presidential nominee William Wirt won Vermont, becoming the first third-party candidate to get Electoral College votes, though his 7 electoral votes did not affect Andrew Jackson's decisive victory over Henry Clay. The anti-Masons were largely absorbed into the Whig Party. Free Soil Party. Barn burner Democrats and conscience Whigs, anti-slavery factions, joined the remnants of the short-lived abolitionist Liberty Party to form the Free Soil Party after the Mexican-American War. Free Soilers won a handful of House seats between 1848 and 1854. Former President Martin Van Buren, who had served one term as a Democrat a decade earlier, was the Free Soil presidential nominee in 1848, but didn't win any electoral votes. As the U.S. expanded westward, the Free Soil Party advocated banning slavery in the new territories, but not abolishing it in the places it already existed. The party describes its principles with the slogan "Free Soil, Free Speech, Free Labor, and Free Men." Free Soilers pitched opposition to slavery on economic rather than moral grounds, arguing that expanding slavery would take jobs from Northern whites. The party dissolved after the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 thrust slavery further into the political fray, upending the political coalitions. Despite its short life, the Free Soil Party laid the groundwork for the Republican Party. Know-Nothings. The outgrowth of a secretive nativist movement, the anti-Catholic American Party opposed immigration, especially of Catholics. If asked about the party, members would say they know nothing, leading to the nickname. Know-Nothing nominee Millard Fillmore, a former Whig Party president, won Maryland and its 8 electoral votes in the 1856 election. Though they won only a handful of House seats, the Know-Nothings showed there was a deep interest in anti-immigration policies and the political salience of ethnic and religious divisions. Populists. Agricultural distress late in the 19th century catalyzed the rise of the populists, who advocated aggressive economic and political reforms. Known formally as the People's Party, populists wanted to nationalize railroads, enact a graduated income tax, and directly elect senators. They supported the free coinage of silver in opposition to the gold standard's fixed monetary supply. In the 1896 presidential election, the populist cross-nominated Democratic nominee William Jennings Bryan, remembered for his Cross of Gold speech calling for free silver. The movement was largely absorbed into the Democratic Party after that. The party was a force in only two presidential elections, but many of its reforms, including a graduated income tax and the direct election of senators, were adopted during the later Progressive era. Progressive Party, Bull Moose Party. The Bull Moose Party, formed to back Teddy Roosevelt's 1912 campaign to return to the White House, which he ceded after losing the Republican nomination to William Howard Taft in 1908. Roosevelt came in second in the Electoral College, finishing ahead of Taft by then the incumbent. Roosevelt's 88 electoral votes were the most ever won by a third-party presidential candidate. By splitting the Republican vote with Taft, he allowed Democrat Woodrow Wilson to win. The Bull Moose platform included women's suffrage, an 8-hour workday, and a crackdown on big business. Roosevelt's strong showing showed the popularity of such reforms, and many were later embraced by both major parties. Dixiecrats. Southern Democrats opposed to civil rights legislation formed the segregationist States' Rights Democratic Party. Better known as the Dixiecrats, the party lasted for just one presidential election, nominating South Carolina Governor Strom Thurmond, who won four southern states in 1948. The success of the Dixiecrats broke decades of Democratic dominance in the South and made clear that civil rights was a potent wedge issue, an insight that Richard Nixon would later exploit in his Southern strategy to win over white voters in the South. Reform Party. Billionaire Ross Perot put fiscal conservatism at the center of his largely self-funded presidential campaigns in 1992 and 1996. Perot won 19% of the popular vote in 1992, enough to help tilt the election to Bill Clinton. Perot's campaigns put a spotlight on the federal budget deficit and the growing national debt, a major force in 1990s policymaking. The next of the front page stories is under U.S. History. A century after a man was convicted of teaching evolution, the debate on religion in schools rages. Story by Holly Mayer of the Associated Press. And out of Nashville, Tennessee. 100 years ago, a public high school teacher stood trial in Dayton, Tennessee for teaching human evolution. His nation still feels the reverberations today. History remembers State of Tennessee v. John T. Scopes as the monkey trial. The case ballooned into a national spectacle with a courthouse showdown between renowned agnostic defense attorney Clarence Darrow and famous fundamentalist Christian politician William Jennings Bryan, who defended the Bible on the witness stand. The jury found Scopes guilty of violating Tennessee's Butler Act for teaching any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible. A century later, the role of religion in public schools still is fiercely debated. This is a broad-based culture war of which the Scopes trial is just one place lightning struck, says James Hadnut Boehmler, professor of American religious history at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Today, new state laws requiring the display of the Ten Commandments in public school classrooms face legal challenges. As the Supreme Court leans right, there is an ongoing conservative push to infuse more religion, often Christianity, into taxpayer-funded education. Advocates of religious diversity and church-state separation are countering it in capitals, courts, and public squares. "We are fighting on an almost daily basis," said Robert Tuttle, a religion and law professor at George Washington University Law School in Washington, D.C. While attempts to interlace America and the divine are not new, from the last half of the 20th century today, they are driven by a perceived threat among white Christians who think their dominant spot in politics and culture is eroded by secularism or multiculturalism, Tuttle said. Other recent examples of the debate over religion in schools include adding chaplains and Bibles to classrooms, infusing designated prayer time into the school day, and expanding voucher programs that can be used at religious schools. At the Supreme Court, the justices effectively stopped the first taxpayer-funded Catholic charter school and gave parents a religious exemption for LGBTQ+-related instruction. Tuttle's scholarship was used in the recent federal appeals court ruling that declared Louisiana's Ten Commandments law unconstitutional. Citing a similar Kentucky law the Supreme Court ruled against in 1980. Tuttle and his co-author Ira Lupu assert that the principles underlying the Establishment Clause, the First Amendment's ban on the government establishing a religion, remain alive despite arguments that cite a change made in the 2022 school prayer ruling by the Supreme Court. We have good reasons not to concede the battlefield to the forces aimed at eliminating the idea of a secular state, their article states. When they overclaim their victories, others should speak up. The day after the Louisiana ruling, Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed the Texas Ten Commandments bill that easily passed the GOP-controlled state legislature. Lawsuits were filed to block it, and a similar Arkansas law approved this year. Abbott reiterated his support for the new law while celebrating the 20th anniversary of his 2005 Supreme Court victory that prevented efforts to tear down the Commandments monument on the grounds of the state capitol. Texas Values, a conservative Christian law and policy nonprofit, rallied support for the Texas law. If other ideals are shared in the classroom, the Ten Commandments should be able to be shared as well, says Mary Elizabeth Castle, Director of Government Relations for the organization. A similar argument was made in 1922 by Scopes prosecutor Bryan, a one-time populist firebrand who became the face of the anti-evolution movement. If the Bible cannot be taught, why should Christian taxpayers permit the teaching of guesses that make the Bible a lie? Bryan wrote in the New York Times. A teacher might just as well write over the door of his room, "Leave Christianity behind you, all ye who enter here." Castle sees the 2022 school prayer decision as a step in the right direction. There's always just going to be that conflict where people are trying to trample on religious freedom, she says, and so that's why we do the work that we do. The American Civil Liberties Union and other legal groups represent the families in Louisiana, Arkansas, and Texas that sued to block new Ten Commandments laws. A much younger ACLU represented Scopes, who agreed to be a test case challenging the Butler Act. Daniel Mock, who directs the ACLU program on freedom of religion and beliefs, sees a through line between 1925 and what he describes as a present-day assault on the separation of church and state. There are those who want to use the machinery of the state, and in particular our public schools, to impose their religious beliefs on everyone else, Mock says. The constitutional guarantee of church-state separation has served us as a nation quite well over the years in general, and there's simply no reason to turn back the clock now. The ACLU lost the July 10-21, 1925 Scopes trial. Still, it dealt a big hit to Bryan's reputation. He died days later. More than 40 years later, the Supreme Court overruled an anti-evolution teaching ban. The trial inflamed social divisions. Conservatives and fundamentals in the Midwest and South felt mocked by those they considered liberal East Coast elites. They were humiliated, Tuttle said. That's internalized, and it carries through. Moving now into local stories. Help sought for couple who lost 6 horses, racing supplies, in Coles County Fairgrounds barn fire. Story by Rob Stroud. Out of Charleston, a fundraiser is underway for Brown Racing proprietors Chris and Jill Brown following the loss of 6 of their horses in a barn fire Friday evening at the Coles County Fairgrounds. Local harness racer Cassidy Witten has organized a Support Brown Racing After Tragic Fire page at GoFundMe.com to help the couple as they also face the loss of a dog, lots of equipment, most of their hay, grain, and supplies. Any donations would be greatly appreciated to help get them back on their feet and deal with this loss. Thank you in advance for your help, Witten said. Bystanders assisted with the evacuation of approximately 40 horses that night from the barn that was on fire and 2 adjacent barns as firefighters battled the blaze. Kenneth Lucas of Mattoon said he was heading home from Walmart when he noticed flames coming from one of the barns. Lucas said he pulled into the fairgrounds and ran in to help horse owners Chris and Jill Brown, who were trying to keep the fire down. We got out as many horses as we could until the smoke and heat overwhelmed us, Lucas said. For all that was there with me trying to save those beautiful horses, bless your hearts. For the few we lost, I'll never forget. Those weren't just horses. Those were someone's best friend, someone's lucky token, someone's love and joy. But most of all, those horses were alive, just like us. The Charleston Fire Department has reported that the barn was a total loss and that they are still trying to determine the cause of the fire. Those three barns and others on the fairground horses that compete in summer harness racing events at area fairs, including at the upcoming Coles County Fair on July 27th to August 3rd. Next local story is from the Crime and Courts section. 18 months prison for gunman in baby shower shootout. Story by Tony Reed. Out of Decatur. Another of the gunmen caught up in a fierce firefight outside a building hosting a Decatur baby shower has been sentenced to prison. Wakil M. O'Neill, 28, was punished with 18 months incarceration after he admitted the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. The plea was part of a deal that saw Macon County Circuit Court presiding judge Thomas Griffith dismiss several other weapons charges, including possessing a firearm while being a member of a street gang. The charges date to the evening of November 17, outside a building in the 1100 block of East Cantrell Street that had been rented for the baby shower. A sworn affidavit filed by the Decatur Police Department said O'Neill was among several armed men who themselves came under fire from other gunmen outside a house in the 1100 block of East Lincoln Avenue. Detective Brian Kaler, who signed the affidavit, described dozens of bullets flying back and forth between the two sides. Police collected 97 fired bullet casings and 3 unfired bullets from outside the Cantrell Street location alone. They later found 38 fired casings in 2 different calibers lying outside the East Lincoln Avenue address. Kaler said the two groups of gunmen blazed away at each other, regardless of the fact they were surrounded by occupied homes and innocent bystanders. O'Neill's case had been scheduled for a pretrial hearing July 3rd, but after he changed his former plea of not guilty and agreed to the plea deal, he was sentenced June 4th. Another of the alleged gunmen, Malik T. Curry, 27, received a 15-year sentence April 15 after he admitted being a felon in possession of a submachine gun. That charge, however, dates to a different crime committed March 14th. Curry had also been charged with possessing an automatic weapon during the baby shower shootout, but that charge was dropped as part of a plea deal. A third accused gunman in the baby shower violence, Leonthis J. Manns, 25, is pleading not guilty to the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. He is free on pretrial release and is due back in court for a pretrial hearing August 26th. The next from the local section is a columnist's, I believe this is an opinion piece, by Rich Miller, from the State House. Rich Miller, Illinois must make changes before snap cuts enacted. The cost to Illinois' government because of the new Republican Congressional Budget Reconciliation Law will be steep. However, the state has some time to prepare itself, and possible Democratic gains in the U.S. House and Senate next year might be able to reverse or mitigate some of the steepest cuts to food security and health care programs before the vast majority of them take effect after the 2026 elections. In the interim, Governor J.B. Pritzker could also lower some of the state's direct fiscal impact with a big administrative effort, a fact that has been glossed over in pretty much all news coverage so far. Without substantial changes to the state's administration, Illinois' share of increased mandated cost for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program might total $788 million a year, money the state clearly does not have. Governor J.B. Pritzker claimed last month that the SNAP proposal would cost Illinois $1.2 billion a year, but his projection was based on the U.S. House's proposal. The Senate version, which passed the House, scaled back that number. The reductions won't begin until the 2028 federal fiscal year, which starts October 1, 2027, so the state has a chance in the meantime to improve matters on its end, and that effective date is almost a year after the 2026 midterm elections. If current trends continue, Illinois will have to pay 15% of the total SNAP benefit costs, which, according to the governor's office, would be $705 million a year. The reason the state is on the hook for 15% of benefit costs is because of its high SNAP payment error rate, which stood at 11.56% in fiscal year 2026, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The state's error rates for underpayments to SNAP beneficiaries was less than 1%, but its overpayment error rate was 10.6%. The new federal law requires that states with SNAP payment error rates of 10% or higher must pay 15% of SNAP benefit costs. The state will struggle mightily to afford that, so lots of people may lose their food aid if things don't change. 11 states, including New York and New Jersey, plus the District of Columbia, had higher error rates than Illinois, but 38 had lower error rates. If Illinois could reduce its error rate to above 8% but below 10%, on par with states like Michigan, Ohio, and Texas, then it would pay 10% of benefit costs, or $470 million a year. Reducing Illinois' error rate to a recent 15-year average of what the Food Resource and Action Center says was 7.1% would make its annual penalty 5% of benefit costs, or $235 million a year. And if Pritzker's administration could decrease the error rate below 6%, then the state would face no additional state penalties at all. Illinois achieved those lower error rates five times between 2011 and 2017. Eight smaller states, including Wisconsin, had error rates below 6% in fiscal year 2024. Unless the law is changed, reducing the error rate has to be done, or it's going to eventually cost the state a fortune and or result in huge numbers of people missing out on aid. Governor Pritzker frequently touts his administrative prowess, so this gives him a measurable opportunity to prove it. But he doesn't have much time because the first increased SNAP payment will be based on the state's performance during federal fiscal year 2026, which begins this October. The state needs an all-hands-on-deck approach to this problem. The new law also requires states to pick up the tab for 75% of SNAP administration expenses, which will cost the state an extra $83 million a year, according to the Greater Chicago Food Depository. States currently pay half the expenses. However, regardless of Illinois' error rate, the state's SNAP outlay could very well be lower than $708 million, because the new federal law will likely result in significantly fewer SNAP recipients, mainly due to work requirements. If history is any guide, up to a quarter of recipients could lose some or all of their benefits without any actual corresponding increase in employment. Illinois will have to work hard to make sure people don't fall through the paperwork cracks, but that will also mean it'll cost the state more money to pay a portion of their benefits unless it manages to get its error rate under control. And we will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of your Decatur Herald and Review, dated Tuesday, July 15th, 2025. Please stay tuned.